9:05, welcome back to the Chad Hasty Show on News Talk 790 KFYO. An open line Friday, your opportunity to call in throughout the show. Sound off on really anything that you want to talk about, whether it be local, statewide, national, international sports. You want to talk about the Baker Mayfield article? Yeah, we can do that a little bit later on if you want to do that. We can also get into really any topic that you guys want to talk about today. 770-5790, toll free, 1-800-687-0790. Joining me in studio right now, the director of the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University, Dr. Ben Powell. Welcome back.
Hey, Chad. Good to be back with you.
Well, I appreciate you being in studio today. This week has been a big week as far as Democrats go and the White House trying to discuss income inequality and the minimum wage. And it's really because you have the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. Let's talk about that a little bit. The 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. How's that going in your mind?
Yeah, actually, I think everybody's got the wrong spin on the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. The Democrats are saying, oh, we've got to do more on this war because there's too many people who are still poor. And the kind of Republican response to this is, hey, look, the rate of poverty is around 15% now. That's what it was back then. The war is a failure. Mm-hmm. And I think both of these perspectives are really wrong, because what happens is we adjust the definition of poverty up over time.
Right.
In fact, actually, one thing that we don't count when we actually measure people in poverty is the welfare benefits that they receive. So you could have an infinite increase in the welfare transfer and see not a dime's bit of difference in the poverty rate in the United States. So it's just kind of bizarre of how the whole thing's measured. But that said, if we think about how poor people, rural poor, urban poor, were living at the beginning of the War on Poverty and how they live now, it's dramatically different. Regardless of what they're calling the rate of poverty, people live much better. Yeah. And I think that's ultimately the important thing. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week that was drawn on government sources of what the typical family classified in poverty owns. And here's the list. The typical American living below the poverty line in 2013 lives in a house or an apartment that's in good repair, equipped with air conditioning and cable TV. The home is larger than the home of the average non-poor French, German, or Englishman. He has a car, multiple color TVs, a DVD player, and more than half of the poor have computers and a third have flat screen TVs. This, to me, does not sound like the poverty of 1964, for that matter. Yeah. If you ever get on a plane and visit a poorer place in the world, the abject poverty that we see in other parts of the world. Now, I don't think this is attributable to the war on poverty. Mm-hmm. What we've had is tremendous economic growth since 1964, and it's lifted the well-being of everybody in society, not just the rich.
So does that mean we need to go through and maybe revamp welfare, revamp what we really take a look at when it comes to poverty, maybe redo the definition of poverty in this country? What do we do as far as that goes?
Well, I think redefining it would be a good idea to count benefits within it, so if you want to try to measure how poor people actually live. But beyond that, the more fundamental question you're asking, I think is an important one, because I think ultimately a lot of what happens in the poor relief becomes barriers to people escaping poverty. I mean, in particular, actually, some of this isn't targeted poor relief, but is the way that we do public education in the United States, where you see multiple generations of the same family go through the same lousy school system, have the same lousy education, and not escape poverty. I will say, though, that that is the anomaly to the people in poverty. Because if you hear the rate of poverty, you know, was 13% a decade ago and 15% today, most people, it conjures up in their mind like the same stagnant group of poor. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same 15%. There's actually a tremendous income dynamic. There's a University of Michigan study that looks at this. And what they find is they break people up into what we call, you know, quintiles, the bottom 20%, the next 20%, so on up to the highest 20%. And when you look at a 10-year or 20-year period, what you find is the vast majority of people who are in that bottom 20% have graduated to the middle or even upper 20%, and that very few of that upper 20% are still there, mostly because they retired, so their actual income stream then goes down. You know, you go through your life of earning. Most people in their 20s, right out of college or out of high school, don't earn as much as they are going to when they're in their 40s.
Right.
Some of them are classified in poverty temporarily then, and later on they go up, hit peak earnings, and then drop out of that top group because they retire. Mm-hmm. And so it's a misconception to look at this 15% and think of the stagnant poor. That said, there are some stagnant ones, and I think there's local poverty traps that often are caused by government policy.
Well, when you hear people talk about, and it's been obviously a big debate, extending benefits, adding more to welfare, and you do have some Republicans who have come out, and they made the point that I think you just made just a bit ago, where you said there are some policies that we make that keep people in the place that they are. They don't necessarily lift anybody up. You're just keeping people in the same spot. Is that what we're seeing, some of the policies that have gone on, not just during this administration, but past administrations as well?
Sure. Yeah. No, this isn't just about Obama. This is a continuation of years of government anti-poverty programs. I mentioned schooling as being one, because when you think about how do people escape poverty, you get better education and you build human capital through engaging in work in the workforce.
Right.
So the bad education in poor neighborhoods is one problem. I think that's separate from the welfare programs per se, but it's a contribution to people who get stuck in poverty. But then the second one is we want to encourage people to get jobs and build the skills so that they go through that life cycle earnings over time. And the tragedy is when we put in policies in place that discourage the person from taking a job that will help them eventually climb out of poverty, or we put barriers to entrepreneurs who would like to create the jobs for these people. So when we talk about redoing welfare benefits or something, what you want to do is lower the penalty for people who accept jobs. So if you have a situation where you lose benefits one for one for money you earn, you're not incentivized to get a job, but that means you're always going to be dependent instead of eventually becoming self-sufficient through getting a job and increasing earnings.
Yeah, visiting with Dr. Ben Powell, Texas Tech Free Market Institute. Different ideas have been brought up. President Obama, I believe on January 28th, will be delivering State of the Union. It's expected that he'll do another push for the minimum wage, and it's something that we have heard for months now, that we have to have an increase in the minimum wage. That's what's going to bring everybody up, close the income gap, close the gap between the rich and the poor.
Chad, you know, just when people bring up the minimum wage, it's, you know, for an economist to talk about it, it's got to be like it was to be whoever Liz Taylor's last husband was on the wedding night, of like, I know what to do, I know how to do it, but how am I going to make this original this time? Because economists have been talking about this since they're blue in the face, about how the minimum wage doesn't lift people out of poverty. And it's a favorite policy that keeps coming back, largely because it's symbolic, and they tweak it in ranges where it doesn't matter a heck of a lot for most people. Mm-hmm. So something on the order of 98% of people who earn the minimum wage are under 25 years old. It might not be, it's a high number, whatever it is. It's not actually an anti-poverty program, because it's addressing people who have jobs at the beginning of their life cycle. It's not right for the people who are perpetually impoverished and having children and into their 30s and 40s. But that said, what it is it's an important barrier. We were just talking about getting that first job and starting to build human capital and skills. Even if that first job is a minimum wage job at McDonald's, just the fact that you show up, learn how to work a cash register, learn how to interact with customers, that becomes a skill that leads to later earnings.
Right.
And when you put a higher minimum wage, it discourages employers from creating these entry-level jobs. They replace them with fewer employees that are higher skilled, or add machines to low-skilled employees and have fewer of them overall. Mm-hmm. Economists have studied this for years. There was one, I'll call it infamous book, that came out back in the mid-90s that cited a couple markets in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and said, oh, we can't find any effect. But the overwhelming bulk of economic research in the almost two decades since then has been, yes, it does cause unemployment. Now, of course, you could have a minimum wage that doesn't cause any unemployment. If we had a minimum wage at 1 cent per hour, it would be non-binding for every single person in this country. Unfortunately, at the range that we're talking about today, it is binding for some people because their productivity is not above that.
Right.
And it's particularly youths and minority youths who get hurt by it. But they get hurt in the two-step thing. They don't have a job today, but then they're not building the skills in their early 20s that get them better jobs later on.
Right. And I you look at it and you bring up that economists, they hate talking minimum wage. They hate talking about raising the minimum wage. But you do have some that have said it's a great idea. And you have an administration and you have the Democrats right now who are going, this is the great, it'll be the greatest thing ever. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's so.
Do you have a public that's just not educated on it?
I think we have a public that's not educated, or that see, the problem is, right, is that the empirical evidence doesn't smash them in the face. Mm-hmm. So the politicians always tweak this around an area where it's not going to affect most people, so it's not going to give you a big increase in unemployment. Because these jobs are often high turnover jobs, you don't all of a sudden see McDonald's lay off a bunch of workers.
Right.
Instead, as people turn over, they just don't replace the same way. So if they ever did, and actually we have in the United States before, by the way, put a minimum wage in that was hugely binding and caused massive unemployment. The very first one that was put in was in 1937 in the Fair Labor Standards Act. It was set at 25 cents an hour. I think average productivity in the U.S. at the time was about 62 cents an hour. And notice that's 37, 38. That's your double dip in the Great Depression. But more importantly, they set it for all of the United States, including its territories. Puerto Rico, average productivity was about 3 to 4 cents an hour at the time. You had massive unemployment, business failure in Puerto Rico. They had to amend the law. Yeah. So, but if you put a big minimum wage in, it would become real obvious to people. For most people, though, since they don't feel the effects, it's something symbolic they feel good about. Yeah, of course, everybody should earn $10 an hour or whatever. Yeah. And they feel better about it. For the economist, the ones who have crossed over on this. So Paul Krugman's a good example. I like beating up on him. He recently in a column came out in favor of it as the right thing to do. But if you turn to his textbook, the one that he actually writes to teach students, he writes in there, what's the effect of a minimum wage? It's unemploying young and low-skilled workers. If you go back to his reaction to the Card and Kruger book, that book from the mid-90s that came out, he said, they're basing policy conclusion off sketchy evidence that flies in the face of established economic theory. When he was being an economist, he was against the minimum wage, right, or at least he understood the effects. You could, in practice, be in favor of it. You could say, I like the minimum wage because it's symbolic, and so what if it hurts some people? But Krugman doesn't say that now. He basically has transferred from being an economist to being a pundit, and he lets that get in the way of good economics.
What would happen if we got rid of the minimum wage? It would never happen. But well, let's just say you get rid of the minimum wage. What do you think would happen?
For people whose wages are above the minimum wage now, nothing. Mm-hmm. For people who are unemployed right now, who have low skills, who might like a job, more low-wage jobs would be available for them. And for that matter, fewer black market jobs that are paid under the table would exist because it would be easier to legally employ people. Mm-hmm. So it would be a boost to employment for lower skilled people. That said, we're not going to see wages all of a sudden plummet to $3 an hour in the United States for somebody.
Right.
Even the productivity of the least skilled, newest immigrant to the United States is something above that. But it doesn't rise to the level of $8.50 an hour or $9 an hour necessarily. And for those people, if we create $5 an hour jobs, it would be a better outcome for them. Mm-hmm. And particularly $5 an hour jobs in the normal above ground economy, so that they become taxpayers and part of the system and everything else too.
Yeah. Visiting with Dr. Ben Powell, Free Market Institute, the director of the Free Market Institute. Recently, you were on The Independents on Fox Business. How'd that go?
It was great. It's a great new show. It's on weeknights at 9 o'clock. Kind of fills in for Judge Napolitano's old Freedom Watch show. Very different style, though.
Yeah.
More laid back and casual, to say the least. But we were talking about the long-term outlook for the economy in 2014 there. And
what do you think? What do you think? I mean, today we get bad economic numbers today, but, you know, granted, these things can flux. You know, we see where next month they may revise the numbers that we saw today. What do you think 2014 looks like?
Yeah, I mean, the bad numbers that you see today, I think, are part of – now, of course, they do fluctuate, as you point out, but it's part of the new normal in the United States. So what we've had – this is no longer the recession that we're in. We're recovered from the recession. Most of the bad investments into housing have been liquidated. Starts are back up. The business cycle part of it's over. It's just we got sluggish growth.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did preceding the recession and during the recession was economic freedoms in the United States declined dramatically.
Yeah.
By the side, so there's a strong relationship between growth rates and freedom. More free, you grow faster. Improvements in freedom, you grow even faster. We've had decreases in freedom. So when economists study this and look at the numbers, basically it's about 1.5 to 2 percentage points slower that we should expect to grow as a result of our new lower level of freedom. That means it's economic growth in like 0.5 to 1.2% type range, which means sluggish numbers like what you're seeing should be the new norm, not a signal of a recession or anything like that.
Yeah, it's just going to be continued high unemployment, it looks like. And a lot of people out of the job market, which is not good for this economy, obviously. And it's not good for the different pieces of legislation, I think, that the administration has put forward. You've got the Affordable Care Act, which...
Sure.
Who knows what the impact of that long-term is going to be when it comes to the economy?
We're going to learn new things about the Affordable Care Act probably every week this year.
Yeah.
But one thing that we do know about it is it penalizes employers who have full-time employees that they have to provide health insurance to.
Yeah.
So when you talk about unemployment numbers, there's also underemployment numbers.
Exactly.
Of the people who are working 29 hours a week because the employer doesn't want to have to kick in on the health care part of it. People who would like to work more and employers who would like to give them more hours who don't. And this is just a product of government policy.
Well, and then if you have minimum wage raised and you've got the employees who are working 29 hours, you have the business owners who have, you know, planned for that. They have looked at that. Now they're going to have to cut back on employee hours even more, possibly. And like you said, it affects the young people, and it affects people who are closer to that poverty line.
Yeah, it's overwhelmingly, if you look for unemployment effects related to the minimum wage or just overall negative effects, it's youth minorities. That's where you get the biggest hit. Yeah. Youth over, and it's, by the way, it's no accident. If you look around the states that have minimum wages higher than the national, the big ones on that are the ones where the youth unemployment rates, the unemployment rates for people under 25 are the highest in the nation. Hmm. Turn and look to Europe, who has a, relative to their average income, higher minimum wages than the United States. You have massive youth unemployment throughout Europe.
Yep.
It's no accident what we see.
Dr. Ben Powell, Director, Texas Tech Free Market Institute, appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, Chad. Always fun.